Lecture 11, October 5th, 2022. Lecture notes page is 93. We know about this opportunity to get smarter by hearing from Mario Gambelli. We know about this opportunity to give back by helping with networking. Test results shouldn't be any different than the last time we talked about it, other than what? Then mini test 5 is open and it'll close on Saturday. Enhanced learning extra credit and pack back number 3, closed tonight on schedule. 4 will open tomorrow on schedule. So a new thing. In the syllabus, I mentioned to you the opportunity for us to help researchers at the university when they need participants. And we have a researcher who needs some participants, okay? So she's going to offer up a survey. You spend a few minutes doing her survey, and you add 0.5% in extra credit to your final course grade. Did I mention that last time, or did I not? I don't remember. Anyhow, maybe it's new. I will send it out later today, help the person out, and help yourself out as well, yeah? So that'll be forthcoming. When you see research extra credit number 1, that's what that's about. We know about the midterm exam, right? So 17% of your grade, it's what's covered in mini tests 1 through 5. That's through the one that closed last Saturday. 50 questions, timed, proctored. You need to have a working camera, mic, and screen. Do a fresh reboot of your computer before you take it. No need for a code or a password. And if it claims you do, first reboot and try it clean. Second, go to Proctorial Help on my course in Canvas and click on Proctorial Troubleshooting, or it's asking me for a code. If nothing works, write me. But this stuff should fix it up. So questions on the midterm. We've been over this before. Questions, 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 midterm. I mentioned last time that we're going to post midterm grades right after the midterm closes. So it'll be based on your first 5 mini tests plus midterm 1 and any earned extra credit. So about 36% of your final course grade. I guess I could have. Mini test 6 is about to open, isn't it? Well, we'll leave it where it says it was. Don't worry about it. It's fine. It's fine. All right, this gets a little long, as some of my stuff sometimes does, as you know by now, but it is advice to B2B marketers, which is our topic that we're on in our chapter. So these are some trends to watch for in 2022 if you're doing B2B marketing. So innovation and ingenuity are becoming increasingly vital for sales and marketing teams to succeed. The significant shifts in the market influence how B2B organizations handle marketing globally. After 24 months of chaos, innovation is moving rapidly. Marketers are starting to use buyer intent data to increase their social media spending and implement cutting-edge technologies like chatbots and interactive emails in their B2B marketing. So marketing as a profession is constantly changing, and what has worked in the past may not be effective today or tomorrow. This goes back to my idea the first day or two when we talked about you guys are going to be coming up and working in an environment of white water rapid change, and what worked today doesn't work tomorrow. You've got to be agile. So the following trends are expected to characterize B2B marketing this year. A strong emphasis on brand personalization to your clients, to your B2B customers. In comparison to B2C, B2B marketing is more difficult as more decision makers are involved. We have not yet talked in class about the buying center per se, but we did talk about the family and the roles in the family decision-making process, and we saw that would complicate our marketing. It's also true in business, but it's called the buying center. So a certain level of professionalism needs to be maintained across all these people, but your marketing efforts should attract attention, and your brands have to be visible. No one buys things that they aren't aware of. Brand personalization allows your company to stand out among competitors and have a distinctive brand positioning. So we're talking about positioning the brand in a B2B world. What do you want it to represent? What image do you want in the mind of those B2B clients? You have to build that. When customizing your brand for your clients, it's essential to keep your target audience's voice in mind. What words they use, what level they are at, do they have catchphrases that you should use when you talk to them? When building a brand voice, make sure you know how your customers speak and what they look for in a B2B partner. Consistency in brand voice across all marketing channels is critical for earning and keeping the confidence of new and present customers. So trend 1, strong emphasis on brand personalization. 2, alignment of marketing and sales. I like to pretend everybody plays nicely together. We're all integrated and working together to satisfy the needs, wants, and desires of clients and consumers that are profitably integrated after the firm. In the real world, that doesn't always work that way. Research shows that sales teams ignore 80% of leads generated by research in marketing. So marketing and sales are seen as different camps in many organizations. A report by HubSpot showed that sales and marketing misalignment costs businesses a staggering $1 trillion a year. Hey, pay attention to my research. No, I don't want to. Only 2% of sales and marketing teams consider their working relationship as excellent. So the increased emphasis on integration comes as no surprise. Remember, an integrated effort of the firm, Marketing 101, do it in the real world. Strengthening the relationship of these two departments will drive marketing's impact on the bottom line, increase productivity, and help better hit KPIs, key performance indicators. Increasingly, we also see software platforms incorporating these changes in their digital tools. In 2022, we'll see more of these two silos communicate productively and collaboratively with one another in an integrated way. Trend three, use of intent data. This is data talking about what your buyers or potential buyers intend to do, what they're looking for, what they're interested in. In 2022, the economy's digital revolution and the expansion of e-commerce are anticipated to ignite substantial upheaval in the B2B market. Marketing campaigns are no longer based on demographics and general preferences, but instead use predictive and hyper-personalized B2B marketing strategies. Today, 68% of B2B buyers prefer doing business online rather than the classic purchase through sales staff, leaving an enormous digital footprint behind. If I'm out there searching for stuff, looking at your website, looking at competition's website, I'm leaving cookies all over the place. You can track some of those things legitimately. So based on activities such as looking for specific keywords, what content buyers are consuming, or visiting you or a competitor's website, buyer intent data helps you to discover people online who are actively in the market for your kind of solution. So now you've already prospected, you've already begun to see who's interested in you and your kind of product. Understanding buyer intent and buyer experience supported by data-driven decision-making is a long-term B2B marketing trend. So we have marketing analytics, you guys have data analytics, hopefully tied into this idea of better understanding these large data sets. The popularity of video marketing. Video marketing activities are perfect for grabbing viewers' attention as individual attention spans continue to shrink due to the abundance of fresh content available. 78% of marketers indicate that video content directly helped them to increase sales. Video content has surpassed blog articles and infographics as one of the most popular forms of content on the internet that your clients might turn to. Businesses can create a compelling story about what they do, showcase their expertise, and offer authentic client testimonies through these engaging videos. So here's the importance of digital marketing in the B2B world. As visual content marketing trends evolve, your company must keep up with the latest practices to increase sales. So a bit about technology and marketing. A fifth trend, growth marketing. Growth marketing uses several communication and marketing methods to test and design the best strategy for growth. Growth marketers assess different channels to see which content gets the most traffic and then optimize each of those channels for each user segment. So this is using marketing research to get action, take action. In fact, A-B testing, that's actually through research comparing channel A to channel B, message A to message B, omnichannel marketing, having information across all of the various channels that you sell through, and multivariate testing to understand the audience's preferences and then apply them throughout the customer journey are the main growth marketing tools. Back again to data analytics also. Therefore, marketers enhance each funnel stage and build strategies based on this knowledge. This marketing segment will drive how growth and success are measured in 2022. Sixth, here's the omnichannel marketing idea. We're going to talk about it later on. We mentioned it before. Omnichannel marketing is a multi-channel approach to sales that seeks to provide customers with a seamless shopping experience, whether they're shopping online, from a desktop, or mobile, or by telephone, or in a bricks and mortar store. Question? I'm sorry? Just stretching. So more companies are taking an omnichannel approach to marketing and client service, in response to digital acceleration and increased needs of the B2B buyer. Omnichannel marketing is a client-centric, cross-channel approach that provides a seamless client experience and improves connections across channels and touch points. B2B clients are becoming more accustomed to this B2C style brand approach and B2C style client experiences. Omnichannel is the standard, not the exception, so you have to be engaged in it. Further, according to a Tech Republic survey, 75% of B2B customers would buy from their provider again if they have these omnichannel capabilities. Wherever I go, I see the same stuff, I get the same feel, I'm able to order the same way, search the same way, whether I'm at my desktop, on my laptop, on my digital phone, or in your B2B store. New lead generation channels is another trend. B2B marketers' top goals are still generating quality leads and driving conversions, that is, driving sales. Lead generation and conversion methods are projected to alter dramatically this year. One thing to keep in mind is that marketing does not work with a one-size-fits-all approach. Mass marketing is tough to do in a B2B world. For optimal impact, marketers must consider the customer's preferences and based on their age group and adapt to these changes. One study found that most baby boomers prefer the old-style tender process, or RFP, request for proposal process, and my asterisk there is meant to say these are processes that invite bids for large projects that have to be submitted to the vendor in a finite time period, but that's drastically more than millennials. Only 39% of those like that old style, and only 31% of Gen Xers like that style. What are these folks like? Almost all, 97% of younger customers are more likely to prefer marketplaces, an e-commerce site where you can do B2B business and use platforms like Amazon and Alibaba to do B2B sales. So in contrast, only 19% of baby boomers use these purchasing channels. So here we have to understand our consumers in the B2B world preference. One survey showed that 80% of B2B buyers research and then purchase their products on Amazon, making Amazon the lead generation channel of the year to come. Optimizing for new types of searches, such as audio searches, visual searches, will be critical to grab traffic. Additionally, marketing chatbots and AI, artificial intelligence, can assist marketers in reaching out to more customers while reducing wait times. So technology and marketing. And the eighth of these trends for B2B marketers, B2B marketers now have access to online resource centers, blogs, content hubs, etc. Original research out there in these sites almost certainly will become even more vital for marketing efforts in this year. Marketers need to provide useful content for their actual customers and potential customers. For example, a common misconception is that B2B purchasing is rationally led instead of like the B2C world's emotional purchasing, but the rational approach only works for short-term sales activation. Long-term brand building, staying in with that customer over a long time period, is based around the emotional priming of customers, which evokes emotions about the salesperson, about the brand, about the company, builds associations, positive associations, learning with the brand, and increases its salience so that when that client goes to think of a new need, they think of your company first. Thought leadership content helps businesses elevate their brand perception, instill strong trust, and improve their overall reputation. Writing to your target audience is always a sustainable B2B marketing trend that grabs and retains users' attention regardless of your digital marketing strategy. So, uncertainty and digital change will almost certainly significantly influence B2B marketing this year. New techniques and technologies might aid businesses in adapting to a market where purchases are more interested in digital channels and customized content. So this year, marketers must be agile and prepared to adapt to any changes to reach their target customers effectively. That was a long haul with a lot of trends and a lot of information to the B2B world. On the much lighter side, in the B2C world, how many of you guys have heard about McDonald's new Happy Meal for adults? We didn't talk about that in here, did we, or did we? No, you guys, has anybody ordered it? You've heard about it but haven't ordered it? So you ordered it. Oh, you've heard about it. You want one? Well, there you go. An aside, I haven't gotten to the story yet, but an aside, there's been some Twitter postings by McDonald's employees begging people to stop ordering the meal. They're getting so many orders. They're getting swamped, I think, with online orders. It's crazy for them. So what am I talking about? You pulled up to McDonald's as a full-on adult. You absolutely do not need a toy with your meal, right? Joking. Of course you do. The fast food chain is now selling box meals geared toward grown-ups, and each one has a cool, odd-looking figurine inside. So, new product. The meal has an odd name. How many of you guys do know Cactus Plant Flea Clothing Line? One person? You guys are fashion. Shouldn't everybody in fashion know? Are you in fashion? How do you know it? You just know it. All right. So I'm a little surprised at that. So anyhow, this is a sort of a streetwear brand. Fresh, interesting, quirky ideas for clothing. So they paired up with McDonald's. So that's the fashion brand collaboration on the promotion. So we're seeing brand partnerships. According to McDonald's, the box is inspired by the memory of enjoying a Happy Meal as a kid. The outside of the box is multicolored and features the chain's familiar golden arches. You can choose between a Big Mac or a 10-piece chicken McNugget. It comes with fries and a drink. Pricing is set by individual restaurants and may vary. When this writer attempted to order it through their app from a McDonald's near them in Charlotte, North Carolina, it cost slightly more to get the burger box over the nugget box, but both could be purchased for a little less than $10. I've also seen it listed for $12. For this price, the item came with the medium fries and drink. Purchasing the same edible contents and drink through the app from a location near them without all the razzle-dazzle, regular old meal, cost $7.49. So basically, I paid $2.20 for the little toy and the nostalgia box. You have to decide if that's worth it to you. So pricing in the marketing mix. Here's one of their promos for this new product.
Hey, Cactus Buddy.
All right, Cactus Buddy.
Rubble, rubble.
Go, go, go! McDonald's!
Welcome to McDonald's. Everything you order?
The box! The box!
And apparently a boatload of people are going to box the box. Make a point here. So the Cactus Meal folks apparently have their own emblem. So everybody's got two sets of eyes. And this is their, the Cactus folks, I guess, what? Brand mascot, I guess I would say. So a little lighter weight idea than all of that stuff for B2B marketing. All right, so we pick up lecture notes, page 93 and 158 in the textbook. Back to the idea of understanding B2B marketing. So last time we were mulling over this idea of the concentration of business markets. And we were making the point that, for example, in manufacturing, if you're putting out a sales force, you don't need too many people in New Mexico and Arizona. They're concentrated in different areas. Additional differences between B2C and B2B buyers and characteristics of the business market. Businesses buy from other businesses to help them achieve their objectives. Again, not just to make them happy or feel pretty. Such as reduced costs. If you can go to a potential client or an existing customer and tell them how your solution will reduce their costs and so increase their profits, you got their attention. Their goals also might be to increase revenues. If you can show how using your product would bump sales up and therefore profits, you got their attention. Or if their goal is to have enhanced social responsibility, be more sustainable, be more green, and that's one of their goals, you got their attention. So they're buying from these businesses to help them to achieve their objectives. In deciding among the various suppliers that are out there, buyers consider a variety of factors. Well, certainly price, which I suppose you might consider as well in your purchase. Delivery schedule. I need your product, and we've heard a lot of this business about supply chain problems and things not being where they need to be, when they need to be. What's your delivery schedule? When will you be where I want you? How often have you not met your delivery schedule and are going to cause my production problems? Past performance in general with others and with us. Your production facilities and capability. I plan to grow. I plan to go international. I plan to have a new ramp up of product. Can you grow with me? Can you fulfill my need? Warranty and claim policies. Technical capability. I have very fine specs that you have to hit? Can you hit them? And, well, there we go, and quality specifications. So these are the Brian criteria that's sort of like your evaluative criteria in our other model that we talked about. You guys know from maybe management, you guys know ISO 9000 and the other ISO standards? Not a thing we talk about? Yeah? No? So there's a series of ISO standards out there from the International Standards Organization that a person who wants to sell to businesses can be qualified in. So ISO 9000, for example, standards for registration and certification of a manufacturer's quality management and assurance system based on an on-site audit of the practices and procedures developed by the International Standards Organization. And you can't really figure out what's going down here, but here's a company that just got ISO 9000, and they're so proud, they're out front, they're all celebrating, they got their own little sign. That's going to work well as they prove to potential customers that they can reach their quality specs. So why is all this so important in B2B buying? Well, companies need to buy the right product at the right time, at the right price, because many companies are making less themselves and buying more from vendors. So it's really important in my supply chain that I get the right price, that you send me the right product. It's where it needs to be, when it needs to be. For example, Toyota has something like $25 billion in parts and supplies that they buy that they don't make for themselves or assemble for themselves. Firms cannot tolerate defective parts or supplies. When your part screws up my product, my customers don't care it was you. It's my product that's not doing what it's supposed to do. So you got to get yours right. We have, now again, after the pandemic, we'll see if management moves away from these ideas. But for a long time, we've had this idea of just-in-time and just-in-sequence supply chain. I don't want a big inventory house filled with all my pieces and parts. I want you to deliver pallets and truckloads as I'm producing it, where I'm producing it. And as long as that flows smoothly, it's really efficient. I don't have a bunch of storage costs. Things flow through. Everybody's working more efficiently, effectively, saving money, except when it breaks. And so if we still stick with these ideas of just in time and just in sequence, we've got to have this happening. So firms need to work with fewer suppliers and develop really significant long-term relationships with them to make all of this happen. So we work together on developing new products. So you aren't surprised when I say I need a new material, I need a new size, I need a new spec. We share information on inventories, so no one's surprised if I'm making more or less as that inventory flows to me. And we work together on production and costs. Well, there you go. But the supply chain problems caused by the COVID pandemic does have business rethinking this concept a little bit.
Creating cool stuff that can help you learn about investing in the coolest companies.
Yes.
Or even let you watch your favorite team from the other side of the world. Just imagine what they can do when I'm in charge.
Look at this. Sold out. Can you believe this stuff?
So they were supposed to deliver it in October.
This is going to be an update on the kettlebell shortage of 2020.
I just want my shoe. Give me my shoe, please.
Then it was supposed to be November. No. Then December.
Give me my PlayStation. Am I wrong for wanting this, bro?
I mean, everything just sucks lately.
Take my money. Take my money. I don't want it. Give me my shoe.
Every time I check my email, it's stuck on this right here. I don't even know what that means.
Tonight, one word sums up the feeling along every line of the supply chain. Frustration.
Well, the shortages and delays in the global supply chain threaten a total paralysis.
When the pandemic hit, businesses anticipated that the COVID recession was coming. They thought that demand was going to drop. But something funny happened. The opposite of what all of these businesses and economists predicted happened. Demand exploded.
And they couldn't supply it. Things weren't where. How many of you guys during the pandemic, or maybe still now, got out of stock, still shipping, not with you yet? You're the only guy that's engaged actively in marketing here. But okay, some people are running into that problem. So businesses are rethinking this whole thing. However, it goes in the future. We still have to have good relationships with our suppliers. So we want to develop them from our perspective. Supplier development is the deliberate effort by organization or buyers to build relationships that shape our suppliers' products and services and capabilities to fit our needs and those of our customers. So again, just in time and just in sequence are like that. Maytag has a lot of its suppliers who actually have on-site reps at the Maytag plant. So if there are any issues or problems, they're right there to solve them. Inventory issues, they're there. Quality issues, they're there. Shipment issues, they can start talking to their supplier company to help out. So this is a little bit like family decision making, not at all like you making a personal decision. Most big purchases in business are made with a large group of people called a buying center. Buying center consists of a group of people in an organization who participate in the buying process and who share common goals, common risks, and knowledge that is important to the purchase decision. It is what we call a cross-functional team. You might have somebody there from operations and somebody there from manufacturing and somebody there from marketing and somebody there from sales and somebody there from finance trying to make up their mind about this purchase decision. So from a provider, seller's viewpoint, we have to know who they are. You miss somebody that's important in the buying center, you may miss the sale entirely. What are their individual backgrounds? What are their experiences? And despite it say, the fact that it says here they share common goals, if you've ever put a group, a cross-functional group of people together, you know they all have their own goals in mind, what they mean to succeed. So what are their goals relative to this process? So the roles in the buying center, a bit like the roles that we talked about in the family decision-making process. Often in the company, the gatekeeper may be, if you're doing in-person sales, the gatekeeper may be the receptionist at the corporate headquarter desk. Old-style marketing, you never want to piss off the receptionist. Oh, sorry, he's in a meeting today. No, he can't see you. Take a card, sure. So you always want to have good relationships with people that let you in. These days in digital, who knows who the gatekeeper is? It could be the engineer who's watching stuff come across his desk that's current. Who is the gatekeeper? How do you get good relationships with them? So your information gets into the buying center. Influencers. Influencers are people, just like mom, who's setting the budget but doesn't make the decision, in the company who influence the outcome but may not make the decision themselves. There's an interesting example. Somebody was making a big pitch, a big sale, was pitching to the company, pitching the company, pitching to the CEO of the company. Thought he had the sale, and he didn't. And he went back and he said, just after the fact, what happened? I thought we were good. And it turns out that for reasons unknown, the CEO's wife didn't like the pitch. The CEO's wife didn't like the pitch. She was an influencer who knew he didn't get the sale. Who are the influencers? You got to tease that out. The users. The users could be, of course, the accounting office. The users could be the administrative assistants. The users could be the people on the manufacturing floor. Who are the users of this thing that you're selling? How do you include them? What are their needs, wants, and desires? The buyers. Oftentimes in major organizations, we have somebody whose dedicated job is to do the buying. They put out that request for proposals. They bring in folks, they write the contract, all that little detail of the contract language, and negotiate terms. Who are they? What are they looking for? And then, of course, who is the decider? Is it the CEO? Is it the accounting guy? Is it the guy on the manufacturing floor? I don't know. You got to know that. So it's important for us as marketers to these in this B2B world to understand this complex idea of who is in the buying center. We find that what I just said changes a little bit depending on the type of buying situation. If we're just talking about a straight rebuy, we're just going to go buy some more paper towels, some more pencils, some more toilet paper, some more machine oil, you don't really need a buying center for that. You probably tell the purchasing agent, go get me some toilet paper, and they have a digital list of suppliers that they go to, and they make that purchase. So that's a straight rebuy. Modified rebuy, something's different. There's a new player in the market. There's a new product in the market. For me, every time a new textbook rolls out, I have to take a little look at it and see, is this worth considering or not? It's not that I pulled in everybody in the entire marketing department to look at it, but should I consider this or not? So modified rebuy gets a few more people involved as you have these new criteria or new products or new players out there. Should we consider them? And then in the situation of a new buy, this is something where we don't understand the players, the providers, the criteria on which to buy. We don't know anything about it. So we decide we're going to put in a robotic manufacturing line, and we don't know nothing about robotic manufacturing lines. We're going to put in robotic professor. Hi, there will be no mistakes today. We don't know anything about it. So this is where you're absolutely going to have a buying center where a whole bunch of people in the organization are going to get involved in this brand new complex decision. What sort of product are you selling? What's the buying situation for your clients? What's it mean for the way you talk to them? So in a table format, we see that a straight rebuy usually has one person involved, the purchasing agent. Decision time is short, buy toilet paper. Problem definition is well-defined. Buying objective is usually low-priced supplier. The supplier is considered mostly in the present. It's usually pretty hard to get in on these simple purchases if you're a vendor. And the buying influence is the purchasing agent. In terms of a modified rebuy, well, you might get 2 to 3 people involved. What's this new product out there? Who is this new player out there? Decision time goes up a little bit as we consider these other options. Problem definition is something with some minor modifications given the new players, given the new product. Buying objective is still to get the low price supplier that you understand and trust, I guess. I would say I'd change this table a little bit. Since things have changed a little bit out there, it's a modified rebuy. You look at your present, certainly, vendors, but you might consider some new ones. And the buying influence is still going to be the purchasing agent and these other people that were pulled in. Then for the new buy, lots of people are involved, a big buying center with a long decision time as we try to figure all this out. We don't really understand what it means to have a robotic production line or a robotic instructor. Buying objective is just a good solution. Our suppliers considered are new and present, and the buying influence is the whole buying center that's all the people in that buying center. So you have to be aware as a marketer how you're being viewed by your potential customer. This is a little comparison, probably again overwrought, from the textbook, I think, that talks about comparing the stages in the decision process for a consumer versus an organization. So a consumer is thinking about purchasing a smartphone. Why? Well, they don't like the features of the smartphone they have now. They'd like a new one. Sort of an emotional thing, maybe. In an organization, marketing research and sales departments observed that competitors are improving the earbud headsets for their smartphones. The firm decides to improve the earbud headsets on its new smartphones, which will be purchased from an outside supplier. Information search for a student buying a new smartphone, they use past experience, maybe they chat with some friends, they look at ads on the internet, maybe they look at consumer reports, they collect information, they uncover possible solutions to their problem. In the business world, we design and production engineers draft specifications for headsets. The purchasing department identifies suppliers of the earbud headsets, puts out a request for proposals. Alternative evaluation for the consumer, they consider various smartphones out there on the basis of whatever's important to them, price or speed or picture quality. Maybe they look at a couple stores, a couple websites. In the business world, purchasing and engineering personnel visit with suppliers and assess 1, their facilities, 2, their capacity, 3, their quality control, 4, their financial status. Will they be here in 6 months? And they drop any suppliers that don't meet those criteria. Purchase decision, the individual student buys a specific brand of smartphone, pays the price, and leaves the store or the internet site. In business, they use quality, price, delivery, and technical capability as key buying criteria to select a supplier. They then negotiate terms and award a contract, a little more complicated. Post-purchase behavior, the student evaluates the purchase decision. If they don't like the phone very much, they might return it. In a B2B world, they evaluate suppliers using a formal vendor rating system, and they notify a supplier if the earbud headsets don't meet their quality standards. If the problem isn't corrected, they drop that firm, as a future supplier. So the stages are similar, but the details are quite a bit different. Here's an example from Hershey's milk chocolate. I mean, you guys, Hershey's, we know Hershey's, right? So it's pretty good milk chocolate. Their problem that they ran into was diabetes in America. 18 million Americans had it when I put this together, and it was growing at a 10% rate annually, and consumers wanted sweets that wouldn't blast up their, what is it called, their whatever the thing is, their diabetes, whatever that's called. All right, so Hershey said, well, what can we do? So they began to look around to find the right sugar substitute to help customers who wanted their product but had diabetes issues. So first, they had to define the technical specifications. And, for example, whatever they came up with had to appeal to consumers. So it had to have the right taste, the right texture, the right dietary needs that would meet them. And then on the production side, it had to be easy to use. It had to be available in sufficient quantities for them. It had to cost, you know, it had to be a reasonable cost. So they begin that work. They begin to evaluate alternatives out there. So marketing and production and research people come together in a joint team to evaluate the alternatives out there. Maybe they don't have enough information yet, so they pull in university food science researchers for more information as they evaluate the choices that are out there. We're going to get rid of those that don't have the taste and texture of sugar. Then we'll choose a vendor. We're going to buy the sugar substitute. We're going to integrate it into our marketing mix for the new sugar-free products and market those products, and of course, hopefully, they will sell. So, bada-bing, bada-boom, we have Hershey's chocolate candy sugar-free, Jolly Rancher sugar-free, Twizzler sugar-free, Hershey's Syrup sugar-free, Reese's sugar-free. Now we wait and see whether or not the product sells well. How well did the supplier of the sugar substitute do? How successful were the new products in the marketplace? So, the stages of decision for a candy company. Sephora has made some interesting changes, launching on Instagram checkout with over 80 brands. Instagram checkout may be able to help Sephora further the growth of the brands that it sells. Instagram checkout is a B2B service, so Instagram is the B2B entity here, that allows a brand's users to make a purchase without ever leaving the Instagram app, creating a streamlined two-tap process, converting the Instagram followers into loyal customers. It is helping Sephora to open another channel and one that's frequently turned to for discovery. Sephora said in its press release that the platform allows these brands to scale their business while also providing a connected beauty buying experience across the different accounts. So, B2B sales of a service. So, online buying in organizational markets, well, we know it anyhow, but from the trends, there's a huge prominence of online buying in organizational markets through e-marketplaces. The traditional kind of thing, Amazon being an e-marketplace, but you also in B2B sales get online auctions being used in some organizational markets. So in a traditional auction, a seller puts up an item for sale. Various buyers bid in competition with each other, and since you're bidding for the item against someone else, as the number of bidders increase, there's an upward pressure on price. And the auction ends when there's a single bidder. Who's ever bought something in that fashion, like on eBay, where you're bidding against other people? Just you and one other, oh, three people, all right. So, you know, the more you bid, you bid, they bid, until the deadline comes up, right? So, the more people out there, the more increase in price. Visual learners, we got one seller out there. They have a product up for offer. And as the number of buyers out there increases, the price for the auction increases until it closes. We also, in the business world, have a reverse auction. In this case, it's not the seller that's making the offer. A buyer goes out and communicates a need for a product or a service. And then various suppliers bid in competition for that business to provide whatever it is that buyer wants. Here, as the number of suppliers increase, there's a downward pressure on price. Oh, he can do it for $100,000? I can do it for $90,000, just as good specs. You know, you can do it for $80,000. So we have downward pressure. So the auction ends when a single bidder supplier is left, who obviously meets all the criteria for that buyer. So here we have the opposite of what's going on. We have lots of sellers, and we have many sellers out there. We have one buyer, the more sellers you have, the higher the lower the price goes. So as the number of sellers increases, the price drops. And finally, somebody buys this product. A while ago, I think maybe this was during the lead up to the terrible housing bubble, so it's been a while, they showed a series of bankers all dressed up in their suit and tie sitting in the hallway of up to a kitchen. And at the kitchen table was Mr. and Mrs. Consumer. And they were interviewing the bankers to find the best mortgage deal that they could find. So the bankers were the suppliers going up trying to get the best deal to get the business. So it can happen in a consumer world as well. All right, so that's B2B marketing. So we've thought a little bit about B2C. We thought a little bit about B2B. Now I'm going to turn to trying to get products out to those folks. And we're going to start with the idea of getting them out globally. So you understand there's a bunch of people out there. You would like to sell to them. Let's think a little bit about reaching and understanding global consumers and markets. So one question would be why? Why bother? I mean, why not just stay at home? And one thing is to get access to materials or products or services which are not available domestically or which are available but at a higher price, lower quantity, less technology. So let's think about government and the world as it is today. Most of the solar panels are manufactured in China. Government policy is no longer enthralled with the idea of that. So government policy is now encouraging domestic manufacturing of solar panels. But if you need solar panels, you're still going to China, you got to get it there. Also, many computer chips, although now we're opening a computer chip thing near Columbus, right? We know that. But until that's up and running, we still got to buy chips from somewhere else. We don't have a lot of choice. Or we might want to engage in international trade to get access to markets who want our materials and products and services. How many more Starbucks stores do we need to build in the U.S.? Anybody been to Manhattan recently? Yeah, I mean, there's a Starbucks there, there's a Starbucks there, there's a Starbucks there, and one over there. How many more Starbucks stores do we need in Manhattan? What about in China? So we have other places to go. Because of comparative advantages, our nation has inexpensive labor, your nation has high technology, I need some of those things, I don't have them easily here. You have a competitive advantage, I'll work with you. So some countries have unique national or human resources that give them a competitive edge internationally. If you want diamonds, what state in the U.S. do you mine a lot of diamonds from? As far as I know, it's no state are you going to mine a lot of diamonds from because it's not a natural resource we have much of. Ignoring the problem and issues of blood diamonds, let's all be ethical, Africa is going to have the resources to provide diamonds. So that might be another way to go. So this, I guess I'm really touching on what I just talked about a minute ago. Market saturation at home, we don't need many more McDonald's or many more Starbucks. Potential demand, folks out there might want our product. And your clients are going internationally, and they want you to supply them too. They expect you to go with them. And so your customer expectations are another reason to go international. Now, the pandemic has led to a surge in online spending in the biggest shopping revolution in the West in malls and supermarkets, but it is in China, not the West, where the future of e-commerce is being staked out. The China market is bigger, more creative, and tech firms there are blending e-commerce, social media, and more to become the online shopping business for 850 million digital consumers. What's the U.S. population one more time? We said it last time, roughly. No, not 10 anything. Somebody over here had it last time. Nobody. Thank you. U.S. population, that's not just people, adults buy, the population, 330 million people. Chinese digital shoppers, 850 million people. The China e-commerce market overtook the U.S. in 2013, and today is worth more than $2 trillion, more than the U.S. and Europe combined. The China e-commerce market is dynamic, highly competitive, leading to innovation such as demolishing the boundaries between different types of services that, where those boundaries are still common in the West. They blend digital payment, group deals, social media, gaming, instant messaging, short-form videos, and live streaming celebrities into a single platform. In the West, Visa specialized in payments, Amazon in e-commerce, Facebook in social media, Google in search. The West is largely underestimating the future of global if they aren't seriously considering what's going on in China. Multinational firms like Unilever, L'Oreal, and Adidas make more revenue in Asia than they do in America, and they look there, not to California or Paris, to see the latest in digital marketing, branding, and logistics. To be competitive, some Western firms are diversifying. Facebook promotes shopping services on its social networks and engages in social commerce, including live streaming and the use of WhatsApp for messaging between merchants and shoppers. Walmart hosted its first live shopping event using TikTok, a Chinese-owned app. From electronics to solar panels, Chinese manufacturing advances have been ignored or dismissed as copying by the West, then downplayed and grudgingly acknowledged around the world. This should resonate with you as our example of Michael Scott looking out, seeing technology out there. Yeah, yeah, it's there, but I'm selling paper. It's not important. We look out there, we see the stuff, and then until it bites us in the butt, we dismiss it. Get in front of it. Today, it's Chinese consumers' tastes and habits that are going global. Well, what does this mean to the U.S.? Well, we talk about the balance of trade. Maybe you remember that from macroecon. That's the difference between the monetary value of a nation's exports and imports. So in the U.S., do we export more or dollar amount, export more or import more? 50-50 chance. We export more. We import more. Okay, you guys are all on target there. So here we say the exports are in red, and our exports, until the pandemic, exports were growing. It's not like they were declining. We were exporting. But as you see, imports, until the pandemic, were also growing. And so while exports are up, imports are up even more. So the balance of trade is negative. I let the economists and the government worry more about that. I'm a business person, so I guess I don't care. If I'm importing, I could be making money. If I'm exporting, I could be making money. So I'm not too sure individually I'm concerned about that. We'll let the government and, you know, the economists worry about what's going on there. I think this gives us the current state of affairs. So 2021, 2022. So in January, negative balance. In February, negative balance. In March, negative balance. April, May, June, July, August. So we've got overall negative balance still going on, although it's a declining negative balance, interestingly enough. We'll see where the year takes us. Any questions on this? We're good. We in Ohio would love to have you come from another country and set up business here. Ohio is the 9th largest exporting and the 11th largest importing state in the nation. With a one-day drive to most major U.S. metros, the Cincinnati region's location means products arrive at the customer's door faster, dear international global marketer who wants to do business in the States. Our strong logistics industry moves large and small items via air, river, rail, or road. So here is foreign direct investment information. Makes your transition to the U.S. easier. We have a website set up for you if you want to do business here in Ohio. And this will be the same story, I think. International investment companies abroad benefit from Ohio's strength. And here's a whole bunch of information about how to invest in Ohio if you are a international company. So we're interested in bringing stuff into you. I mentioned before that some countries have inherent advantages called competitive advantages in labor, in the economy, in natural resources. So a guy by the name of Michael Porter, who you might know from management, thought about the dynamics of world trade and talks about the competitive advantages of nations in something called Porter's Diamond. His question, why do some industries and firms become world leaders and others lose ground or fail? And he says, let's look at four issues related to countries. Firm strategy, structure, and rivalry, demand conditions, related and supported industries, and factor conditions. And he says these are all interrelated as we try to understand business success and failure. Factor conditions, for example, natural resources, diamonds, gas. What's going on with gas in Europe right now, natural gas? Pipeline got blown up. Who knows how? These things happen. Russia's reduced, or they're not buying as much from Russia anymore. Germany has a massive industry built around the use to develop chemicals. BASF is one of these companies, massive. And they produce things in insecticides and in clothing products and in plastics. And it's very uncertain what's going to happen come this winter if it's a cold winter and they have to tamp down use of natural gas. Are you going to let your country people go cold while your economy continues? Are you going to cut down on the economy so to keep your people warm? So natural resources are an issue. What about the educational and skill levels of both your people who are potential employees and of potential customers? What are the wage rates there? Kuwait specializes in the oil production of oil because that's their big thing. They're not going to grow a lot of soybean in Kuwait. Hollywood is the film production star as it has a concentration of skilled labor and excellent film schools. Of course, if we're thinking a little more global, where's the other place that comes to mind as a huge film production center? Anybody? Yeah? Where's Toronto? They play a lot. I don't know if they also produce it a lot. I know they have the Toronto Film Festival, but okay. I was thinking a little more exotic. You guys, Bollywood. Yeah, you guys know Bollywood, Mumbai, Bollywood, yes, no? Anyhow, that would be another place that has these concentrations. Japan is an island nation. They've done pretty good for themselves considering the fact that as an island nation, they don't have a lot of raw materials. Because they haven't had a lot of raw materials, it's created a culture of doing more with less. So we find that the idea of miniaturization, using less materials to make things small and still get the job done, is a corporate culture thing there. Just-in-time inventory came from them, so there's not a lot of stuff sitting around. Zero defect manufacturing, influenced by the fact that they have very minimal resources on their island nation and are still being quite successful with these strategies. So the question might be, can we produce in this country, given its resources, educational skill levels, and wage rates? Can we produce there? If we're thinking about going global. Demand conditions. This talks about the size of the market, both in terms of numbers and dollars. The sophistication of consumers. How you can get information out about your product, media exposure out there. So in general, German consumers have demanded a high level of engineering in their cars. So companies like Mercedes, BMW and Porsche have allowed Germany to dominate the world in high-performance cars. On the other hand, they don't do so well in the cheap, mass-produced car market. Their customers are not interested in that. So, is there a demand for our product? Will people understand what we're selling? Can we get our information out to them? Is there enough numbers and money for our market, for our product to succeed? Related and supporting industries, what about the existence of supplier clusters? National strengths are associated with clusters of industry. Silicon Valley in the U.S. has a certain advantage, although perhaps that's a waning advantage, we'll see. Here we go. In Germany, there are similar clusters around chemicals, BASF being a massively large company, a chemical company that is doing that. So there are supplier clusters around in the world. Can you get the support that you need to do whatever it is you're doing in this country are the suppliers out there. And company structure, strategy, and rivalry. How many folks are already in this country doing whatever you do, providing the service you provide, providing the product you provide, and how intense is the competition? They've been there for a long time without you. They've been competing among themselves, and they're being successful. Are they publicly or privately owned? If they're owned by the government, they may have subsidies that make the cost of their products way lower than you can get, than you can work with. So competition in a country can drive innovation and drive upgrades. Japan, small country, island country, had 9 major car companies plus foreign competitors driving innovation. The first, and this of course is very common now, but the first cup holder in the world in a car came as an innovation from Toyota. For a while, it gave them a huge advantage in the marketplace. Now we have 5 cup holders in all our cars. But the competition itself can drive what's going on. So given all of these things, can you be competitive in the country you're going into? I'm told that Starbucks is doing a bang-up job in France, but is yet to be able to establish a foothold in Italy. I think I heard there was one in Milan. Why? There's competition there, and people seem to prefer the local competitors who build up their image. And so far, as I know, Starbucks hasn't been able to succeed in Italy because the number of competitors are there, very high, the competition is intense, and consumers like what they got. So firms that succeed in global markets first have to have succeeded in intense domestic competition through continuous improvement, through innovation, through managing change. Your way to success if you're failing in the U.S. is usually not to try to sell in another country. You couldn't make it here, suddenly you're going to make it over there. How's that going to work? So usually you have to be successful here. Okay? We talked about trends in the B2B world. Let's take a look at some of the trends in today's economic world. So we have issues of economic protectionism. The prior U.S. administration favored economic protectionism. The current one is more in favor of open trade. We talked about the crust factors, factors outside your organization that you can't control but influence your consumers and your business. C, competition, R, regulation, legal, and whatever the other one was. Regulation, legal, and something. What is it? Anyhow, so what is going on with the regulations, the legal environment for you that in this domain? Should Congress, for example, use political situations as a reason for more protectionism? Buy U.S., we're only going to make in America, let's not get engaged with other economies. Some politicians argue that the benefits of today's relatively free trade system go unfairly and primarily to low-wage countries, and they say that those low-wage countries take jobs away from Americans. We would say that factually that's not very accurate. What I say is your particular company may have suffered a little bit because of international trade. But looking at the big picture, that international trade where those people are doing more manufacturing grows that country's employee base. They have more money. They start buying stuff. They start buying stuff from us. It goes back and forth. So it's not just a matter of, oops, my job went to Mexico. It's much more elaborate than that if you look at it overall. America's economy over the past few decades has proved that openness coupled with flexibility makes the economic pie much bigger. It grows for everybody, and that the benefits can be widely shared. A while ago already, but still, President Ronald Reagan, who was a Republican, said, "A creative, competitive America is the answer to a changing world, not trade wars that would close doors, create creative barriers, and destroy millions of jobs." We should remember that protectionism is destructionism. Working just domestically is not a good way to grow. The China-U.S. trade is an ongoing economic conflict situation. 2018, President Trump began setting tariffs and other trade barriers on China with the goal of forcing it to make changes to what the U.S. says are unfair trade practices. Among those trade practices and their effects are the growing trade deficit, which we just looked at. The theft of intellectual property absolutely was a problem, probably continues to be a problem. And the forced transfer of American technology to China. If you're going to do business in our country, you need to give us your technology. We would not like that very much. The trade war, of course, negatively impacted the economies of both the U.S. and China. In the U.S., it led to higher prices for consumers and financial difficulties for farmers and manufacturers because China then set tariffs on our products. In China, economic growth and growth of manufacturing activity slowed to their lowest rate in decades because we weren't doing business with them. In other countries, it's also caused economic damage, though some countries benefited from increased manufacturing. Since we weren't dealing with China, we're dealing with Thailand, so Thailand might benefit. Complex stuff when we talk about this. China has been GM's largest retail sales market since 2012. A favorable relationship between the U.S. and China is important for maintaining its business relations within the country. The pandemic, a weakening Chinese economy, and trade wars with the U.S. have all impacted our home country manufacturer, GM sales. So here we see their sales in China and the U.S., starting in my little data set here in 2018. And we see that in 2018, they pretty well exceeded the U.S. sales as they did in 2019, as they did in 2020, as they did in 2021. So there was a decline overall, but they're still selling more in China than they are here. So we have this interesting little chart. Protectionism can come in two formats, tariffs and quotas. Who can give me a simple definition of what a tariff is? What is a tariff? Webbies? What's a tariff? Oh, we have somebody who knows. Yay. So a tariff is? It's a tax on imported goods. That's right. And who's going to pay that tax on the imported good?
Us.
We do. There's a misconception that somehow the country that we put the tariff on is going to pay the tax? No, it's our importers that are being taxed on the product coming in. If they're taxed on the product, they probably aren't going to eat that tax, are they? They're going to pass that along to y'all. So, tariffs are a government tax on goods or services entering a country, primarily serving to raise prices on imports. Now, what's the effect, of course, going to be on the sales of those imported goods overall? What's going to happen if they cost more money to us? What's going to happen to their sales? Thank you. They're going to go down. These are not the hard questions. These are the softball questions. Also, we have quotas. So what is a quota on international trade? What's a quota? Yeah?
It's a cap of the amount.
We're going to cap the amount of stuff that you can bring into our country. So it's a restriction placed on the amount of a product that's allowed to enter or leave a country. So tariffs increase prices, quotas limit supply, and what effect do these protectionist behaviors have on world trade? Well, duh, they both decrease world trade. There may be good political reasons to do it, but it's not that we're going to grow the pie. It's not that we're going to have more economic activity. We're going to have the opposite. A number of years ago, after World War II, we had an organization that was supposed to work in this domain, and that was a treaty, not an organization, called the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And in the old history books, you might hear the word GATT. It was a treaty, not an organization. It ran between 1947 to 1994. I believe technically it's still there in the background. I think that treaty still exists. Its focus, given its time period, was on trade. There was not much about service because service wasn't a thing, so it was talking about merchandise trade. And its problem was there was no dispute mechanism. So it was a treaty on how we'd all treat one another, we'd all be fair, and we'd all do the right thing. And then when you didn't, there was no way to dispute the topic. You couldn't do anything. So it was replaced by the WTO. How many of you guys have heard of the WTO? Yeah, okay. So the WTO has some major goals. It has not achieved these major goals. These are goals. Trade without discrimination. It would like everybody to trade equally with everybody else, but it is willing to see that that's not happening anytime soon. So instead, it's accepting of regional trade agreements, the EU, a regional trade agreement, the US-Mexico-Canada agreement, whatever we have now, regional trade agreement. They would have as a goal predictable and growing access to markets. So if you're going to have some kind of tariff, make it fair and the same for everyone so everybody knows what it is. And your access to the market isn't fraught with confusion as these tariffs come and go. Promote fair competition. Encourage development and economic reform. Over 3/4 of its members are developing countries. So I do have enough time. So just as I sometimes get long-winded, the guy we're going to hear from here is the retired chief economist of the World Trade Organization, Patrick Lowe. Anybody know we have a program in Geneva, Switzerland, international program there? So this guy used to come and teach for us in Geneva. So one time, actually I have some pictures of him, and we went out and drank. I'll show you the pictures later. So this is Patrick Lowe droning on a little bit, I admit it. And when he gets filmed, he can be animated after a few beers, but when he gets filmed, he gets very, very monotone as he goes through his stuff. So we're going to hear him talk a little bit about the World Trade Organization, where he viewed it at the time that he did this video.
My name is Patrick Lowe. I'm the chief economist at the World Trade Organization. We are an international trade agreement amongst a highly diverse and quite large membership of 150 members. So ours is an agreement. We're not a funding institution of any kind. We're a place where governments come to talk about trade policy, to agree on rules about trade policy, and to agree about the conditions of access to each other's markets. I expect the Commission to take a fresh look at some of the pressing issues facing the multilateral trading system today. And the trading system more generally, international trade relations more generally. In many ways we're at turning points in the conduct and organization of international trade. And this is an opportune moment for some knowledgeable outsiders, most of the Commission are outsiders, to give some new insights, some fresh insights, different ways of looking at things. It's a multidisciplinary body that has huge advantages too. Trade and increasing integration through trade is one of the key features of globalization today. So cooperation is at a premium. And the challenge we have is to make sure that this is a kind of cooperation from which we get buy-in from all nations, all interests. And that is very easy to say and rather hard to do. Interests are diverse, priorities are different. And the question is how can we bring all these diverse interests together in a way that leads to mutual benefit among the cooperating parties. Bilateralism and regionalism more generally has exploded exponentially in the last decade or two, and it does raise the question of what the role of the multilateral trading system, the so-called non-discriminatory basis of the multilateral trading system, is obviously challenged by regional and bilateral agreements. But these regional and bilateral agreements exist for a reason. Governments have seen it in their interests to strike these agreements. I think our job as the, if you like, the core focal point of international trade relations among almost all nations is to play for coherence, to try to ensure as much coherence as possible in these different arrangements, to try to see if we can make a contribution to minimizing the costs involved in crisscrossing arrangements, often competing in many ways, a situation where a pair of countries will negotiate something, and then one of those countries will then negotiate something with somebody else, and that will immediately depreciate what was negotiated in the first agreement. And all the mess that follows from complex networks of rules of origin and differentiated conditions of market access, even though it's clear that governments see value in making these agreements, I think there is an awareness that they're not always the best way of carrying forward harmonious and integrated international trade relations of the kind that the WTO seeks to promote. On the other hand, it's a lot easier sometimes to make agreements among a few countries rather than try to get a universe of countries to agree on things. I think one of the big challenges for the WTO is to ensure that these don't become excessively discriminatory against outsiders. As far as possible, they should be open and inclusive, not exclusive and discriminatory, even if in their fundamental nature they have some discrimination in them. Can we look to a future where this crisscrossing network of agreements will eventually become more generalized into multilaterally oriented agreements where we'll be able to eliminate some of these efficiency costs and difficulties associated with overlapping and potentially excluding agreements. Some developing countries have gone quite a long way in establishing regional agreements amongst themselves, but I think many of them rely very heavily on the multilateral trading system as a bedrock of international rules, where governments make pre-commitments to certain types of policy behavior. I think many developing countries would be quite concerned if they thought that regional arrangements were simply going to substitute for the multilateral trading system. So I think they look to the multilateral trading system to provide stability and continuity and a certain degree of predictability that is not necessarily present in regional arrangements. I think the relative weights of negotiations...
Just calm down. So second of all, I'll cut him off because I can see you've lost interest in hearing from Patrick. But the last point is that their goal is to have equality and fairness in trade, which these regional relationships don't allow us to have. Here's a group of us at the World Trade Center, inside the World Trade Center. Here's Patrick is after several beers, wines, and other alcoholic beverages with some of our co-eds, wearing a cheap pair of Kent State University plastic sunglasses that I brought over to him. All right, now you can go. Goodbye.